I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that is looking more than ever at what we all hope will be an early spring, warm weather, and good health for all Americans. Speaking of America, this week's episode will tackle two movies that give two different views of this country of ours. The first is One Night in Miami, which imagines a meeting between four prominent African-American figures, Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown. Then we'll head to Central Florida, where the documentary Some Kind of Heaven is set, and where we'll meet a number of almost exclusively white residents of a prominent retirement community. Let's begin this week's show by turning the clock back to the night of February 25th, 1964. It was on that night in Miami that the Olympic gold medal winning boxer Cassius Clay, soon to be known as Muhammad Ali, defeated the heavily favored Sonny Liston to become heavyweight champion of the world. And it is that setting in a Miami hotel following the fight that director Regina King, by adapting the stage play written by Kemp Powers, uses to imagine what might have happened had Ali celebrated his victory by meeting up with three of his real-life friends, the political activist Malcolm X, the singer-songwriter Sam Cooke, and the professional football player Jim Brown. King, the noted actress-turned-director, never does manage to open up Powers' play appreciably, and so much of what One Night in Miami consists of is a series of discussions, at times devolving into actual arguments, about what each of the four should do to help advance the cause of civil rights for the nation's Black community. Yet the power of those arguments and how they are made by the four main actors, Eli Gore as Ali, Aldous Hodge as Brown, Tony Award winner Leslie Odom Jr. as Cooke, and especially Kingsley Ben-Adir as Malcolm X, make One Night in Miami a riveting viewing experience.
Well, before we get into a discussion of One Night in Miami, I want to mention that Kemp Powers, the playwright who also adapted his play into the screenplay, also co-wrote and co-directed the Pixar movie Soul from late last year. So he's on, those are two huge properties that he's got his name on. So good year for Kemp Powers. I want to talk about the four central figures here, because even though the details of this supposed hangout are kind of sketchy and we're not even really sure if it happened, just the idea of it must have seemed like catnip to a playwright, to a filmmaker, because not only are you dealing with four larger than life personalities, but all four of these guys are, as the movie begins in February 1964, they're all at critical points in their lives and their careers. So you have Cassius Clay, obviously about to embrace the Nation of Islam and become Muhammad Ali. You have Malcolm X about to abandon the Nation of Islam. And a lot of the drama has to deal with Clay's kind of feelings of betrayal that Malcolm X sort of brought him in. And right as he's about to embrace this ideology, Malcolm X is going to leave. You have Sam Cooke, who's in the process of writing A Change Is Going to Come, which is this, you know, the linchpin of his career, essentially this moment where he goes from being this kind of, you know, smooth crooner to a socially conscious songwriter. And then Jim Brown is preparing to leave the NFL for his acting career. So they're all sort of at these crossroads. And that is what leads to a lot of the tension here. And I think there's added weight in One Night in Miami because we know as viewers that within a year of this very night, Sam Cooke and Malcolm X are both going to be dead. And so there is sort of this feeling that it's kind of this last moment for all of these guys in a way to sort of let loose, even though there are all of these pressures on them, because not only are they Black men in America in the 1960s, but they're famous Black men in America. So they have all of these, you know, advantages, but kind of these unusual disadvantages at the same time. And I think it's interesting that this movie is coming out so soon after Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which was another film we talked about that's based on a play, is obviously based on a play when you sort of look at the visuals of it, and is similarly kind of recontextualizing these Black historical figures and Black art and sort of imagining what it would be like to be in the same room as these people who I think a lot of us, and even some movies about them in the past, have treated more as figures and less as human beings. And I sort of liked the idea that, you know, you're hanging out with Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali, and they're just kind of shooting the breeze. They're kind of giving each other, you know, guff. They're friends, basically. And then we sort of watch as their individual personalities clash with each other. So I liked this movie a lot. I mean, I know there are sort of issues when you take a play like this that's stuck in a single room. You have all of these challenges, and Regina King kind of gives us these prologue sequences, and then, you know, they go up on the roof at one point, and, you know, they go to a liquor store at another point. So she's kind of trying to open it up, but I think we'll segue into talking about the performances, but I think that's really the reason to see this particular film, is this quartet of performances at the center, which are really, I mean, it must have been a challenge, but I think these actors pull it off really well.
I agree. And I think that there are a couple of things, Nathan, as you mentioned, to talk about the performances. And then also, I think we need to spend a little bit of time talking about Regina King as a filmmaker, because, you know, this is her debut, her directorial debut. And so I think that that's, you know, important as well, because to choose a subject matter such as this, you know, had to be sort of challenging, exciting, all of these things at the same time. So we're looking at real people who we know some things about. And now's the time where I get to talk about how I waited on Muhammad Ali when I was a cocktail waitress at the Sheraton Hotel in Philadelphia in 1976. And so I told him, I understand you have the most recognized face in America. And he said, in the world, baby, in the world. and so we did have this sort of bantering back and forth.
Was he a good tipper at least?
He was. I did not get, he had been there the year before, and he gave a much larger tip to the person who waited on him at that time. So I don't know what that says about my service or his financial situation or whatever. But yeah, I was fascinated by the fact that we took these, the playwright and then Regina King took these real life figures with whom we have particular associations, knowledge, and so forth, and expanded on that in ways that were a little bit unexpected. So I think the most interesting performance, and maybe the most interesting take on what happened here, is the portrayal of Kingsley Ben-Adir as Malcolm X. So obviously we've seen Denzel Washington portray him in the Malcolm X movie. By Spike Lee, where he was overlooked for an Academy Award. Yep. I think that this portrayal of Malcolm X is a little bit more tentative and a little bit more, you know, he's not, he's questioning some things about the Nation of Islam. He's questioning his, relationship with Muhammad Ali, then Cassius Clay, who he sort of invited into this religious and cultural tradition. So he's sort of rethinking things. And so I thought his portrayal was really nuanced and sort of a different look.
And he's basically one of the guys. It's a view of Malcolm X that we didn't have. We've always had this view of Malcolm X as this strident, one note, very powerful proponent of civil rights. But here he's just one of the four guys and they're all buddies. And a large part of what he's doing in the movie is talking about his camera and taking pictures, you know, and it's just a different view.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the other performance, I mean, all of the performances were great, but I particularly appreciated Leslie Odom Jr. as Sam Cooke, because again, that was, I mean, he had already reached a point of notoriety that probably surpassed everyone, but then they sort of get into, gee, what's the basis of this? Like, have you sold out in terms of making your art? And so we see his sort of not only maybe struggling with that himself, but also being confronted by his brothers about what he's doing and what he intends to do. And of course, I'm very appreciative of the fact it would have been super disappointing if Leslie Odom Jr., the Tony Award winner from Hamilton, if he had not been able to sing, but fortunately he does in this performance.
The most interesting conversation for me, at least, was when Malcolm X is confronting Sam Cooke about his music, and he's saying, you know, you're taking these gospel songs, these hymnals that are associated with our culture, and you're sanding off the edges, you're making palatable for white audiences. Even though white audiences, we see at the beginning of the film, we see white audiences rejecting Sam Cooke for no other reason than he's Black. And that push and pull between those two guys, but also between Sam Cooke and his own art, is fascinating. And just the whole, have it like wrapping up the whole series of, or the whole history of Change Is Gonna Come into this story, I appreciated too, because he heard Blowing in the Wind by Bob Dylan, and he thought, well, if a white guy can write a song about, you know, the civil rights movement like that, then why can't I? And that's how we got Change Is Gonna Come.
Yeah, and I think that certainly Aldis Hodge, who plays Brown, I mean, again, he's going through a transition from the NFL to being an actor. And so they sort of play with that and make fun of him at different points. And he's this, you know, big, physically imposing figure. And so that's intriguing. And then finally, we have Eli Gorey as Ali. And I thought he pulled that off beautifully. And again, I think the fact that Regina King took this on, because here we have a female African-American filmmaker looking at this portrayal of male bonding, of, you know, Black men getting real with one another, challenging one another, talking about a range of topics. And I just really appreciated what she did here. And so I think this is well, well worth watching.
And that was One Night in Miami. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at the documentary feature, Some Kind of Heaven. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
When you consider the future, please consider Spokane Public Radio in your estate plans. Your gift to the SPR, Fund for the Future, Endowment will ensure that access to real news, meaningful conversations, and great music will continue forever in our communities. One of the most impactful ways listeners can help is through planned gifts. Details are available from the business office at Spokane Public Radio, your tax accountant, your attorney, or the Inovia Community Foundation, formerly known as Inland Northwest Community Foundation. More information at SpokanePublicRadio.org/membership. And thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discussed the film One Night in Miami. Let's now move to the documentary feature, Some Kind of Heaven. You may not be familiar with The Villages, which its website describes as, quote, a collection of quaint retirement neighborhoods located in the heart of Florida, nestled between two beautiful coastlines, ports of travel, and theme parks, unquote. What documentary filmmaker Lance Oppenheim does is go beyond that kind of ad speak and delve into what living in the 55 and over retirement community is really like. Oppenheim focuses on a few residents, mostly on the widow Barbara, the seemingly fragile couple Anne and Reggie, and the layabout Dennis, in his attempts to penetrate into what at least one resident admits is a bubble that is intended to insulate residents from the vagaries and pressures of real life. But for at least those we get to know, that insulation doesn't necessarily lead to a lasting sense of happiness.
I think that this will be an interesting discussion because we do have two people who might be obvious candidates to live in the villages. And then we have one who might be visiting on his winter break or something. But I have to own my own bias here. So the villages is in North Central Florida. If you're not familiar with it, it's about as far away from Spokane, Washington as you could possibly get. It has 150,000 residents and it sprawls across three counties. And I know a little bit about it because my best friend from high school was poised to move to the villages before she met the love of her life on Match.com, and he saved her from what I consider to be a fate worse than death. But that's my bias about the whole thing. Honestly, there's something that just strikes me as so sad and pathetic about this whole living arrangement. And
so
that's
make-believe world, make-believe
right.
history.
Right. It does seem like Disney World has been opened up to
adults.
Yeah, older Americans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you are cordoned off from everything that life presents. But I guess some people seem to be very happy about that opportunity. Although I would say of the four individuals who are showcased in this Some Kind of Heaven documentary, I would say that none of them is having a perfect experience, which is one of the things that I appreciated about this. So we have a woman, Barbara, who's widowed, and it seems like her experience there changed markedly, as is true in the real world for people who lose a spouse and, you know, then are trying to make their way in the world. And then we have this guy who's a total scam artist,
Dennis,
who of course is the most interesting character, although you want to slap him upside the head. And then we have a couple who are going through their own challenges after 47 years of being together. And so that's an interesting portrayal. I felt as though from, apart from my visceral reaction, negative reaction to the whole concept of the villages. And it does have some political overtones too, because please keep in mind, this is the location that former President Trump gave a shout out to as being some of his most ardent, you know, supporters and so forth. But I guess I just felt as a documentary, it was missing. I felt it needed one more character group to focus on. It needed a little bit more context or backstory about why. So why did people move there? Were they trying to replicate their college experience with more money? You know, was it appealing that they would be among like-minded folks? Did they want to drive golf carts as their primary method of transportation? I just needed a little bit more here that I did not get. Now, having said that, Nathan, the youngin' among us, your reaction to this seemed to be more positive than mine, for sure.
Yeah, I love this movie. And I think that its attitude, the filmmaker's attitude towards the villages, is pretty much what you described. I think that he kind of finds it morbidly fascinating in a way. And I think the political makeup of the people that live there and the racial makeup of the people that live there, it's never explicitly spoken about in the documentary. And I kind of found that at first I was questioning that, but I think the omission of it is almost political commentary unto itself, because
these people
have the privilege of sealing themselves off from the world because they have the money and the wherewithal to just completely close everything out. And to me, I think this movie was a bit more vicious than I think you're giving it credit for. At the same time, I think it is very sad. And I mean, particularly Anne and Reggie, who are the couple that you brought up, I mean, the problems that they're having are very unusual. Reggie is experimenting with meditation and LSD and cocaine and thinks he's like a god reincarnated as a human. And at first you kind of laugh at this because it does feel like an Errol Morris documentary. And Errol Morris comes up a lot in reviews of Some Kind of Heaven. And for good reason, it does look like an early Errol Morris film. But after a while, you just really, you start to worry for this guy and you think, honestly, part of the problem is that he's in the villages and they basically just kind of turn a blind eye to him and think, oh, that's just Reggie. You know, he's just sowing his wild oats. And it's like, no, this man needs help. So I do think that there is more commentary in this film than you might immediately pick up on, because it doesn't have, you know, a filmmaker narrating. It doesn't have, you know, talking heads coming in and explaining what the villages are. It just kind of shows you these people. And I was much more interested in these characters than you were, I think. I think of all of them, I agree with you, though, that Dennis almost deserves a documentary because he's trying to find a nice woman who just so happens to be very rich and has a spare room that he can crash in. And his whole grift is fascinating. So, yeah, I liked this more than both of you, but I totally understand where you're coming from. And maybe I'm more removed from it because I'm not in the demographic of people that could possibly live in the villages. At first, I thought, looks like my kind of place. I mean, they've got just like, you know, Ruby Tuesdays
music,
up and down the street.
Have good drinky poos. Yeah.
And then by the end of it, I was like, I don't know about that.
I know, because I did feel a little bit like there, but for the grace of the goddess, go I. And I was simultaneously fascinated and repulsed by what I was seeing and dealing with.
Yes.
Well, I think it's perfect that it's set in Florida, because I mean, this is the world of, the only other place in the world it could be set is maybe Phoenix, Arizona, or Las Vegas, because these are all places that appeal to that kind of Disneyland for adults feel. And I don't know. It some kind of heaven. Heaven is not the exact word.
Be some kind of hell for you. Yeah, is that what you're saying? Yeah. Okay. So
some kind of purgatory.
Yeah. So everybody's heard. We're not moving to the villages. Okay. So promise, Webster.
Right.
Okay. Good to know.
All right. Well, that was Some Kind of Heaven, the documentary. Nathan, before we cut off, you wanted to mention something about the Sundance Film Festival.
Right. So obviously film festivals, at least in-person film festivals, have been put on hold for quite a while now. But the Sundance Film Festival, which I think is probably the most famous independent film festival in the world, is still happening, albeit in a virtual capacity. It starts January 28th. So by the time you're listening to this, it will have already started, but it runs through February 3rd. And if you go to festival.sundance.org, you can look at the entire program. And they're actually allowing people that can't physically go to Park City to experience Sundance and experience these world premieres alongside critics and actors and filmmakers and all of that. A lot of stuff has sold out by now, a lot of the more high profile films. There's no more virtual capacity. But if you go online and look, you might find some stuff that does have tickets available. And like any film festival, sometimes tickets become available right before the movie starts. So you never know. You might be able to get into something.
One of the people with local ties, Trish Harnito, has a short in the shorts program.
Right. And the shorts program is available to see throughout the festival. So if you want to see her film or any of the others, you can see that at the website. I'll be attending in a press capacity and will report back about what I see. But check it out. This could be going forward totally, you know, this could be a game changer for the festival market. So we'll see how it goes.
Right. Well, other festivals have done kind of the same thing. I mean, you can access the Seattle International Film Festival and, you know, and there are a lot of other festivals out there. You just got to do a little bit of searching. At any rate, this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder and Mary Pat Truthart and I discussed both the narrative film One Night in Miami and the documentary film Some Kind of Heaven. Let's take a moment to thank Peter Glarbrick for both producing and engineering the show. We thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that streaming cinema has to offer. Until then, remember these words from the author and social critic Cornel West. We have to recognize that there cannot be relationship unless there is commitment, unless there is loyalty, unless there is love, patience, persistence. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.